Welcome to the first episode of Numbers and Narratives. We are your hosts. I'm Judith Ströhle.
And I'm Laura Edinger-Schunz.
Today, we have the privilege of hosting a distinguished guest, Bob Eccles, a retired professor of management practice at Harvard Business School and visiting professor at Zeit Business School at the University of Oxford. Bob has many other hats on as well. He's, for example, the chair of the private equity firm KKR Sustainability Expert Advisory Council. And in general, he's always busy in creating new alliances, projects, and more around sustainability. With his extensive expertise in sustainability reporting and corporate governance, Bob brings a wealth of knowledge and insights to our discussion.
In today's episode with Bob, we'll be delving into the current developments around sustainability reporting, touching upon the ESG culture wars in the US, the standard setting processes in the EU, and potential future developments in sustainable business. Bob's deep understanding of these topics will shed light on the complexities of navigating this landscape of corporate sustainability.
So join us as we engage in a thought-provoking conversation with Bob, exploring the intersections of numbers, narratives, and sustainability in today's business world. Get ready for an enlightening discussion that promises to broaden your perspectives and deepen your understanding of the critical issues at the forefront of sustainable business practices. Have fun. Okay, Bob. So the first question we ask everyone is to tell us a fun fact about yourself that people wouldn't know.
So my fun fact, which some people know, but most people don't, is that my wife and I keep chickens. We have about 20 chickens and we get fresh eggs every day. And I clean the chicken coop every Sunday. So I think that's kind of fun.
That's lovely. It's a great relationship to nature.
That's very close to nature.
And we also thought about asking our guests if they have a number that relates to their lives. Maybe you can also tell us something about the number of chicken, or is there a special number?
So probably my special number is 410, because that is my personal record in doing a one rep deadlift. I've done 410 once, so I'm kind of fond of 410. Another special number would probably be 10, because I have a 550-pound tire, which I have flipped 10 times in a minute and 45 seconds. So that's like 10 seconds per flip. So 4, 10, and 10. Those are my numbers.
Now we don't have to ask you about your superpower anymore.
You know, my superpower, I flip tires and I lift weights. I'm doing magnets and Ortmeyer again. That got me to 400, 410. And it's been a while and I'm a little older. So, you know, I'm shooting for 350. And so today I've got to do 330 twice. So that's what I do. Those are my superpowers.
Amazing. All right. So before we sort of get into the details, can you just give us a quick overview of your background and what you're currently up to?
Well, I'm 72, so doing a quick overview is a little bit difficult. I've basically been a professor all my life. I was at Harvard Business School for many years and got tenured and retired. As you know, I'm a visiting professor of management practice at Zeit right now. I'm kind of very early into ESG before it was called that, and sustainability reporting, or people even gave it a name. Last 2 years, I've been pretty heavily involved in the ESG culture wars, both as a participant and an observer. I have my GOP outreach campaign looking for where there's kind of common views that you can get between liberals and conservatives. And there's more than people might think when you just look at all the political theater going on and how the press writes stuff up. And probably most recently, a big focus on climate. And because the thing that's interesting to me about climate, there's the so-called eco-right, which is think tanks and foundations and individuals involved in climate change who are as concerned about it as all of my liberal friends. I'm a liberal. But what's fascinating is that they just have very different ways in terms of how they think about it. I wrote that piece. I think you saw what I've learned from conservatives addressing the challenge of climate change. And so I just posted a piece this morning on carbon capture, utilization, and storage. And so right now, I'd say kind of in the culture wars, those are going to fade away. The issues that aren't going to fade away are climate change and DE&I, and that's kind of where a lot of the underlying debate is. I see a path for climate change. DE&I is much harder to me. I'm not quite sure how to get my arms around it. I've watched all the caterwauling over the SEC disclosure rule. You know, the Chamber of Commerce might sue them because they issued a rule, and the Sierra Club might sue them because they didn't include Scope 3. This is like America's core competence. We like to sue each other for just about anything. I think it's a little bit of a tempest in a teapot. I think big companies are going to voluntarily adopt ISSB. If they're in Europe, they're going to have to report according to CSRD. I think people expect too much from reporting. And if you could take half of the energy that people have put into arguing about sustainability reporting standards, and look, I've been in this game for over 30 years. I'm a big fan of sustainability reporting standards. But, and this kind of, it's a question at the end, but I'll go ahead and answer it now. My magic wand would be a carbon tax. I mean, if you really want to deal with an externality, the most effective way is to price it, not just kind of have people report on it. And I wrote a piece on this, learned a lot from conservatives that it basically channeled when I put into it. There's a strong set of conservatives in America, think tanks, economists, who support a carbon tax. And people on the left and people on the right go, oh, it's too hard. We're never going to get there. Let's not talk about it. That's giving up and that's stupid. I mean, if you really are serious about climate change and you really want to do with an externality, put a price on it. So, you know, I'm all in for a carbon tax.
You already mentioned these culture wars and you've been quite involved in that. So I think that would be really interesting to stick with that for a minute. And maybe you can tell us a bit more about what's going on in the US with this war on woke, how firms react to it, and what does it mean for sustainability?
So kind of two good questions, I think. What it means for sustainability isn't really very much at all, you know, and I can kind of elaborate on that more. How firms are reacting to it. So generally what you see companies doing, I think, is they're kind of going a little bit quiet. In some ways, that's not bad because there was a lot of greenwashing before and people were making claims about what they were doing that were excessive. I think a central issue here is the confounding of ESG as sort of material risk factors for value creation and impact, which is positive and negative externalities. And people do ESG stuff and say it's creating positive externalities. That's not true. I mean, the positive and negative externalities largely come from products and services, to some extent from operations. But if you are efficient in an ESG point of view or performing well in your operations, that keeps the world from becoming a worse place. It doesn't make it a better place, right? That comes from your products and services. So companies are kind of being a little more quiet, and then they're kind of moaning that, well, we're being beaten up on the left and we're being beaten up on the right, so we don't know what to do. I think they need to grow a little bit of spine and take control of the narrative and be much clearer about ESG versus impact, as I said. Acknowledge that there are trade-offs, acknowledge that there are externalities, talk about how they're dealing with them, talk about what they can do, what they can't do. When you look at, when you peel back all of the ideological rhetoric on both sides, it kind of goes like this, right? The right is saying ESG is this progressive, you know, political exercise of the woke to force companies to do things from a liberal agenda that are going to make the world a better place in their view, not a better place in our view, and hurt consumers, and, you know, it'll hurt shareholder value creation. The ESG critics on the left that I fondly call the sustainability Taliban, they don't like ESG because it's only about value creation for shareholders, and they say we want to make the world a better place, and whether companies are making money or that, we don't really care. So you've got the right saying companies are doing too much. You got the left saying they're not doing enough. The narrative is the public sector is failing. The private sector has got to pick it up. Companies need to do more. Investors need to do more. Well, they can maybe do more, but there's constraints. There's fiduciary duty of board directors, of asset managers, of asset owners. So the fundamental debate is about the role of the corporation in society. Right? And Judith, you and I have talked about this a lot. Companies need to, I think, have a statement of purpose and be very clear and say, this is our purpose. This is our role in society. This is what we can't do. This is what we can't do. These are the trade-offs we're making. Some stakeholders are going to be unhappy. You can't make everybody happy. You can't please everybody. This hand-waving of, you know, value and values merge over the long term. And if we make all of our stakeholders happy, our shareholders will be happy. It's just not true. I don't care how big you are, how many resources, there's going to be trade-offs. I think if companies were more proactive in shaping the narrative and recognizing there's going to be some crazies on the right, you're never going to convince this stuff is related to value creation because they've got political reasons for not wanting to understand it, raises money, gets votes, the same thing on the left. You know, they're kind of playing to their crowd. But I think if companies were more explicit about and more analytical about what the ESG things they were doing that contribute to value creation, how they're making the world a better place, rather than putting in all those little SDG icons in a sustainability report and kind of waving their hands about how they're contributing to something, that would be incredibly useful. And so that's really about sustainability. It's kind of sustainable value creation for the company, for the shareholders, stakeholders are relevant. The term ESG, I think, in the United States has been it's probably dead for all practical purposes, you know, in terms of people define it however they want to define it. So a lot of people aren't going to want to let it go because they're getting political mileage out of it for a while. But there's so little substance behind it. And a lot of the attacks from the right, these red state attorney generals that they're suing the SEC and the Department of Labor and go and sue the SEC over the climate rule. And they're passing this, you know, anti-ESG legislation in their states, most of which doesn't go through. The stuff that goes through is going to hurt their own beneficiaries. I think that'll run out of steam. But this fundamental debate about the role of the corporation in society, what's the role of the public sector? What's the role of the private sector? That's eternal. And I think if we could get away from, it's entertaining. I've made a meal for the last 2 years writing snarky little pieces about the stupid stuff the right is doing about ESG, what's been, and it's getting boring now. I mean, it's like so easy to write these knockdown pieces. What's much more interesting to me is the engagement that I've had with Republicans and libertarians, and I've written a lot with them. And you can find a lot of common ground when you talk about materiality, when you talk about fiduciary duty. We may have different views on what policies make sense, but that's all part of the political dialogue, and that's healthy and constructive, as opposed to this kind of culture war, which has been frothy and entertaining, but I think in the end, it's more sizzle than steak.
That's really interesting, and I really like that you say, you know, companies need to take control of the narrative again. I mean, this is basically what we're trying to get at here, right? What narratives would we like them to actually, you know, talk about, and how would we like to frame those? So you talked about sort of the role of corporation society, corporate purpose, you know, companies need to be more analytical, show trade-offs. But you also said we expect too much from reporting. So I'd love to understand a little bit from you, like, what is the role of reporting then, right? And how does that relate to sort of everything we just talked about in relation from role of society and role of company in society, as well as, you know, ESG?
So the role of reporting, so let's talk about, so investors and other stakeholders, this information they want about how a company is performing. If we start just with the investors, we didn't always have financial reporting standards, right? I mean, those got formed in the United States when the SEC was formed. Before that, there was a bunch of little accounting firms. They all had their own reporting standards and auditing standards. Where standards are important, it's like pretty basic, but it gives you apples to apples comparisons, particularly within an industry and over time of a company's financial performance. Companies want to report good performance, not bad performance, but the reporting of good performance isn't what drives what that performance is. It's the strategy they have. It's capital allocation. It's how they're dealing with regulations. It's what the nature of the competitive landscape is. It's what they're doing in terms of innovation and new products. So the results of all of those activities and actions and decisions are reflected in numbers that are credible and relevant and people can understand. And even then, I mean, you know, the fight about accounting standards, you know about those pieces I wrote with CASB, they're never settled. They're never done. Goodwill's done this way, done that way. When you go to sustainability, we haven't had those set of standards. So it's really important. This is like a foundation. So we're reporting on climate, we're reporting on water, whatever the particular issue is, we know what that standard is. And it's not going to be perfect. Judith, you and I have written about this. These are social constructs, but we've agreed that, you know, goodwill's booked this way and revenue recognition is done that way and carbon emissions are reported this way so that people can compare the performance. Now, does just the reporting drive improvements in performance? Well, no. Are executive compensation tied to these? You know, is sufficient capital being allocated? There's that survey that, you know, I did with Salesforce and Irem. Over 200 people, they say, oh, it's important. But, you know, the gap between saying it's important and the lack of capital that's going into it and the lack of senior management attention to sustainability issues is a lot. So thanks to the ISSB, and we can get to the CSRD in a minute, you know, you will have a set of standards just like you have with financial reporting standards. So we can compare performance and we don't have to spend a lot of time. If we're an investor saying, how did you measure this thing? Then I've got to make my adjustments. Company A did it this way. Company B did it this way. We know what the performance is. Now tell me what you're doing. Do you have targets? Are you trying to improve it? How are you trying to improve it? How do you see this being linked to financial performance? That goes back to the companies needing to be more analytical and clear in their narrative. So having a set of standards and a global baseline to come out of the ISSB is fundamentally important, but just the act of reporting, this is where I think people sort of expect too much. Simply the act of reporting isn't going to mean that performance is going to improve, right? It certainly, you know, will put a kind of spotlight on where performance isn't improving or going down, just like financial reporting does. But, you know, it's like it's one element. There's regulation, whether there's taxes on things, as we talked about, carbon taxes, competence, you know, awareness of the board and so forth. So, yeah, it's my take on standards. Really important, but it's not the end game.
Yeah, maybe before we get to the ISSB and the CSRD, I would really like to hear your take on terminology. Now, you've mentioned ESG in the past. We've talked about CSR and CR, and we've talked about corporate sustainability. And I think it's still very heterogeneous how firms use these terms, right? Some refer to ESG and some even try to avoid that term at the moment. So what is your take on that? Will we in the future have to find a new terminology, or can we all agree on something?
We'll never agree on something. You know, it's like life isn't like that. People have particular motivations. People are going to create their own terms for capitalism, you know, because they think you can brand it in a certain way. I think that, you know, it was social responsibility, corporate social responsibility for a while. Then it kind of became sustainability. Then there's kind of ESG and sustainable value creation. And there's different levels of analysis, right? There's sustainability of the planet. The planet's fine. It's been around 4 billion years. It's going to go till the sun goes supernova. Whether we're going to be around or not is the other question. I wouldn't worry so much about the umbrella label. I think it's important to take it down to specifics, take it down to climate change, take it down to D&I, then take it a level deeper than that. Like the piece I published this morning on carbon capture, utilization, and storage. Let's talk about that. You're really going to need it to get to net zero. You've got people on the left who hate it because they think it just prolongs the fossil fuel industry. Well, I think that's an ideological argument that doesn't sort of mean very much. Let's talk about permitting, right? If we're talking about climate change, let's talk about rare earths and the fact that a lot of those come from China. So I think if you can get down to specific issues, then, you know, you can have a much more constructive debate. It still may be a heated one because there'll be very different views, but at least we know what we're talking about, rather than CSR means this to you and it means that to me, and ESG means this to you and it means that to me. And, you know, that's kind of where I hope we can get to. And companies can influence that a lot. I mean, if they were to come out and be very explicit and say, these are the ESG factors, let's just say the material risk factors. Let's talk about material risk factors. It's boring. It's kind of hard to politicize that. Let's talk about, you know, positive and negative externalities. Equally boring, which is, you know, a good thing about it. Use that kind of language and then talked in terms of specifics. Call the overall thing CSR, sustainability, or ESG. Call it whatever you want. You know, while you're doing that, I'm going to go flip my tire. I got better things to do than argue about some terminology. I'm telling you.
Great stuff. There's a lot of acronyms that are flying around, and I think, you know, we've mentioned many of them already. The ISSB, so the International Sustainability Standards Board, that's coming up under the IFRS. Well, already exists under the IFRS, the International Financial Reporting Standards Foundation, and we have the CSRD in Europe, the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, and the CSDDD, which is the due diligence directive. So we have all of these wonderful acronyms that I don't
SFDR.
Think we'll get rid of.
That's FFDR.
And there's the SFDR and the ESRS. And we will now have to put a legend underneath the podcast so people understand what we're talking about. But I know that you have been a big fan and a big supporter of, you know, sustainability standardization, or particularly standardization in relation to reporting. And you're very involved in the ISSB from the beginning on, which is great. But you've also been somewhat critical, particularly when it comes to the European pathway forward. So the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, particularly the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive. So why don't you take us through your thinking here a little bit? When are standards good? How far do you think there's too much? Because the utility of standards on the one hand is clear, right? But can there also be unintended or negative consequences? What's your take?
So let me lift it up a level to talk about Europe, to two Europeans over there in old Europe. So I look at Europe and I go, well, economic growth hasn't been very good for the last 10 or 15 years compared to the United States. It's complicated because you've got all these different countries and things. the Green Deal comes along, and as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, you're European, I'm not, the general thesis of the Green Deal is that by committing to be a net zero economy, Europe is going to gain competitive advantage. We're going to develop products and innovation and this and that. And as we kind of go to net zero, we're going to kind of win because we're going to be developing all these other products and services and things that the world is going to need, you know, to get to net zero. And it's like, that's it. That's a thesis. Okay. I kind of get that. And, you know, states can make those decisions around what they want their national policies to be. In the U.S., we're kind of going at it somewhat differently with the IRA. Then when I look at the component parts, and it's kind of hard to see how they fit together because Europe doesn't fit them together very well because it's complicated and there's politics like SFDR getting out ahead of the CSRD, and then the CSRD goes away and it takes in the rebuttable presumption. And now there's the materiality filter that makes people mad. So if you look at SFDR, you know, the intent behind that, as I understand it, was that so funds that were being marketed, it was kind of clear whether they were, quote, a sustainable fund or not. But then politics intervene. Like what defines a sustainable business activity? You know, is nuclear, that goes in and out. You know, is natural gas, it goes in and out. Then it kind of stretches from that to think, well, okay, this is going to influence capital allocation because the Article 9 funds are like bright green and the Article 8 are light green. The data we've got, you know, due to the work we're doing, other people, maybe 5% of the money that's kind of under the sustainable investing label is going to Article 9. I don't see fund labeling as a way to move capital. With the CSRD, it's double materiality. But when you read the general requirements, it leads with impact materiality. And there's some stark differences between the ISSB general requirements, IFRS is one, and then, you know, the ESRS one, which the IFRS S1 sort of talks about it in terms of these things that matter to shareholders, long-term profits, cash flows, so on and so forth. There's almost no language about that in ESRS 1. It's impact materiality. It's the positive and negative externalities, and the way you do materiality analysis is different. It's more stakeholder engagement. Stakeholders should have engagement in business models. I'm not opposed to impact materiality. I think GRI does a great job on that. I think it becomes problematic when you sort of take something that's incredibly complex, and I'm glad that they finally kind of got to an agreement on financial materiality between the ISSB and, you know, the CSRD. But, you know, kind of the CSRD was like, we're going to get a jump and we're going to kind of take the lead and we're going to head of the ISSB. Well, that didn't work out so well. But then when they take the CSRD and the application of it is like to companies so small, right? Public and private. As an American, I like 150 million euros. I mean, what? You know, 40 million euros in Europe, what? I mean, you've got to be kidding me. You think that's a real company? And they've got to do all of this stuff, including they were going to have to do that and with the CSDDD, and I think that's going to change. So I can imagine, you know, the CSRD exists. What I would like to see happen on that is that you would have functional equivalents. Veronica Poole would be a great person to interview for this. And say, look, companies that are doing ISSB, financial materiality, GRI, impact materiality, to find the way from the beginning, you know, that's basically an equivalent framework to the CSRD, just like we've accepted US GAAP and IFRS as equivalent frameworks. That'd be great, you know, and then US companies can voluntarily adopt it. And if they're doing a business in Europe, they're going to have to do this. I mean, Europe can kind of set laws and regulations. But when you kind of step back and you say, oh my gosh, over a fairly short period of time under this Green Deal label, what do I see? I see a bunch of reporting requirements in the CSRD, you know, and kind of labeling SFDR and then trying to reach more into the operations of a company in terms of the CSDDD. And how's that really going to get monitored? And how do you know? And it feels like it's a lot more carrots than, or sticks than carrots. So it's like, if you want to be the world's first net zero economy, great. Like, what's your equivalent of an IRA? So this cracks me up, right? Everybody complains about the United States, and for a lot of good reasons. Let me tell you, I live here. I can see what the problems are. I go, you're not doing enough about climate change. So they go, okay, fine, we're going to do the IRA. The Macron comes out complaining about, well, that's like unfair, you know, competition, you're subsidizing local industries. I mean, in some ways, what the CSDDD does is actually lead to kind of more insourcing, whether that was intended or not. So it's an example to me of where, and I'll oversimplify it, but under the Green Deal with the CSRD and the CSDDD and with SFDR, it's like if we just get companies and funds to report enough stuff, all will be well. Capital's going to flow where it should go. The investment's going to be made. You know, we're going to kind of get to net zero. Human rights are going to be protected. And I just think it's expecting way too much from reporting and putting huge compliance burdens on asset managers and companies. And you know, I think all of this single double materiality, you know, it's a proxy discussion for corporate form. We've talked about that, Judith. You know, I know there's been discussion in the EU. So we have a public benefit corporation structure in the United States, which you don't have in Europe. You've got the mission d'entreprise, whatever it's called in France. 37 states have a public benefit corporation where you can sort of explicitly say, here's the benefit, the positive externality I'm trying to create in the world on some environmental or social issue. 19 of those are in red states, signed by red state governors. So on a voluntary basis, companies can adopt a public benefit corporation legal structure. I think if Europe, again, advice from an American who knows nothing about Europe, I think, you know, if you really wanted to sort of address and kind of have a different point of view in Europe about the role of the corporation in society, and it should be more kind of focused on sort of public benefit issues, sort of going down to the level of company law would be, I mean, it's harder, but it would be a more effective way than thinking that you're going to get there by having the gazillion reporting requirements. So that's my take.
Yeah, thank
you. I think all of these things are sort of well-intended, but when you add them all up, it's just like it's too much and too fast. I mean, what everybody says, right? The U.S. innovates and China replicates and Europe regulates, and there's a lot of truth in both, right?
Yeah, maybe let's stick with this topic of what it really means for the companies for a second, because you already said the mere act of reporting will not really lead to more sustainability. But at the same time, what we need to have is this discussion about the role of business in society, and companies need to have a clear purpose. And what we hear from some of the companies here in the EU that are now starting to collect data on sustainability due to the regulation, they say that it actually helps them to improve their business model. So I was wondering, when you were speaking about this burden and like this wave of regulation, how can companies now react to that, and how can they make the best of it? You know, how can they use it to improve their business models?
So, I mean, I talk to investors more than companies, but I think you're right. They'll say, you know, having these data is useful to us. You know, it kind of gives us insights. But I'm guessing the companies that you're talking to are big, sophisticated companies, you know, as opposed to SMEs and as opposed to private companies. And that kind of gets back to the broad reach of the CSRD. I mean, it's 50,000 companies. And so I think it's one thing to say, you know, very large, sophisticated companies with, you know, $10 billion or more in market cap that have, you know, profound influence because they're so big in their supply chains, you know, they've got the capabilities to do it. I mean, I know some companies that are like leading edge in terms of reporting and sophistication. And implementing the CSRD is going to be a heavy lift. All their sustainability people, a lot of the finance people, they're not doing sustainability value creation stuff. They're just kind of getting their house in order so they can be compliant with CSRD. Now, that's an investment. It's not going to go on forever. Software will come along. People will get better at it. So I think, you know, the cost will go down. So it will improve. I think in some ways, you're right, performance will improve. But is the sheer magnitude of the benefits at a societal level going to be what I think people are hoping it to be? I don't think so. You know, I don't think so, right? You know, I think laws and regulations are important, but they've got to be the right ones. It's like, again, carbon tax is a good example, right? So, you know, if I had to choose between making people report a whole lot on carbon or report just enough on carbon so I know how to tax you, so there's a tax, I don't care if you've got a climate transition plan, blah, 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 blah. Market will figure that out because we can see the impact, you know, on your financial statements of, you know, what this carbon tax is. But I mean, you know, there's other people, like we're going to talk to people in Europe. I mean, it's interesting because I got some negative comments on the piece I wrote with my Republican buddy, you know, Dan Crowley, on the CSDDD. I've talked to some people who are strong supporters of it, you know, since then. And I've learned a lot. They've been good conversations. But here's what's interesting, and I can't really get into this now because I might write something with some of them, so we'll see if that comes out. And if it does, I'll let you know. The way it's been discussed and sold has not been helpful. Okay, has not been helpful. And I don't understand European politics all that much, but I saw that MEP, who's the rapporteur, you call them, Laura Walters, you know, from the Netherlands, after the vote when it didn't go down. And she was really angry. There was this press release and she was angry. And on the one hand, I can kind of understand why she's angry. I mean, she's worked hard on this and, you know, she's been very committed to it. But then she's basically kind of like calling people out and, you know, disrespecting them and, you know, this little German, you know, political party. And it's like, well, that's not how to make friends and influence people, right? Do you want to like make these people your enemies and hate you even more than they do? You know, or do you want to get this legislation passed? And I read a report in Responsible Investor where, you know, it looked sensible to me. It's like raising the size of the company to 500 to even 1,000 people, and it's delaying the implementation. And I think it was you had sort of NGOs that are well-meaning and they're passionate. But a lot of what I see in the NGO world and a lot of what I see in the younger generation, and to me, just so I'm clear, younger generation is anybody under 60, since I'm 72. But particularly the millennials and those kind of folks that are active in the sustainability movement, broadly defined, they're like passionate, and I get it, but they're so naive about the capital markets and they're so naive about how companies work. And so it's a lot of emotion that isn't going to lead to, you know, a lot of productive outcomes. And I think it's good to have, so it's good to have kind of the shrill NGOs because they raise issues and they beat up on companies. But then you need the kind of more practical ones to say, okay, here's the problem. Now, how can we sort of work together to solve this problem? And, you know, and I think, as I've said many times, I think it's really important for companies to engage. And that's been a big change over the last 50, 60 years. Companies just blew everybody off. They can't do that now. They shouldn't do that. There's social media. There's NGOs have gotten increasingly sophisticated. They've gotten more funding. So I think if you could just sort of keep the level, kind of keep the intensity of the conversation, keep the level of engagement, but focus more on the issues and less on the ideology. And on the extremes, the focus is on the ideology because it sort of works. It plays to the crowd. It's how you, you know, raise money if you're a public official. It's how you raise money if you're a foundation. And that's why I think it would be nice to have something that's kind of more in the middle that says, agrees that there's big issues. Climate change is a big issue. There's systemic racism in the United States. But we need to think about what can companies do, what can investors do, and what they can't, and what regulation. And on the regulation part, you know, and so in Europe, you people all like regulation. You know, in the United States, we basically kind of don't like regulation unless we're Democrats. You probably have too much. We probably have too little. And what companies need to do, rather than just instinctively block any kind of regulation that comes along, is they should embrace it and engage it. They should say, well, here's the regulation. It levels the playing field. It makes the rules of the game clear to everybody. And, okay, so maybe it's going to cost us something. It's going to cost everybody something. But it's appropriate for governments to draw boundaries around what companies can do. I just think the EU is trying to draw too many boundaries around reporting and expecting too much from it with no real... like, what's the carrots, right? I mean, you could go out and say, okay, the CSDDD, which I know NGOs won't like, it's completely voluntary. But what's the purchasing power of the EU governments in total? It's got to be a lot. So you say, you know, to qualify to bid for a government contract, you have to be in conformance with the CSDDD. I'm like, okay, that's fine. Your government, you can do it. You can say, these are your criteria for who you're going to source products and services from. One of those criteria is going to be the CSDDD. A lot of those are going to be the big companies, you know, and then it kind of, you know, goes downhill. Am I missing something? Are there carrots that are out there in the EU regulation and legislation to create this net zero economy by 2050 that I'm missing or not? I mean, you tell me, you Europeans, what am I missing? Huh?
I'm not here to tell you what you're missing, Bob. You're here to tell us.
I'll do that over a beer later.
Exactly. But so I think, you know, this is really interesting. So I want to take this up on a little bit of a higher level again. So you kind of said, you know, we need to find a middle ground. And I think, you know, we've talked about these two extremes. Obviously there's always emotions involved, but you know, there's lots of politics involved on the one hand in ideology. There's lots of now new regulation and compliance involved, and your companies are very overwhelmed. So what's your recommendation? Like, what's the efficient way of using both numbers and narratives to sort of bring responsible business into the future? Like, what's your way forward?
So let me kind of answer that from a personal point of view of things that I've done, and you know how much difference it makes, and we'll see. I think on the number side, I was the founding chairman of the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, which has now been absorbed into the International Sustainability Standards Board. And all credit, it was Jean Rogers' idea. It's a great idea. She let me come along and be part of the fun. And what I think was important about SASB is that it sort of identified, you know, what are the material issues on a sector-specific basis. And when you look at what they are, it's like hard to disagree, whatever your political ideology is. And so I think those numbers, by being able to say, here's what the material issues are, you know, in these particular categories, and here's the best way to measure it. And that work is now being taken up by the ISSB, you know, when they do sector-specific stuff. I think that's an incredibly useful thing, right? And you see, you know, many, many US companies, whether they're run by Democrats or Republicans, that have adopted the SASB standards. On the narrative part, it gets back to what we were talking about earlier, which is what is CSR, ESG, sustainability. So I'm going to contradict myself since I'm not interested in what a particular label is, but I have my own label. So with my Republican friend, Tim Doyle, who's a lawyer, we have just filed the paperwork to start something called the Responsible Business Initiative, which will be incorporated in the Commonwealth of Virginia as a nonprofit. And he came out of the Bipartisan Policy Center, which is where I met him, and they had an ESG program, which they ended for whatever reason. And so what we're trying to do is create a nonprofit think tank, which is like, what is the role of the corporation in society? You know, what does it mean to be a responsible business? You know, get down into sort of, let's be clear about what fiduciary duty is. Let's be clear what materiality is. What do companies do? What do asset managers do? And what I've learned from, you know, my initial and brief forays into the political world is that most people in Congress, and I'm sure this is true of most people in Parliament, they don't really understand companies and how they work. And they don't understand, you know, kind of investors and how they work and the difference between asset managers and asset owners. So they take whatever the soundbite is, the signal that's coming from their tribe, and they go out and parrot it. And I know a number of Republicans that go and have private conversations with people in Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, about climate change. There's not a lot of climate change deniers. The way they present themselves to their constituency may be better. I think there's a lot to be gained if we had a responsible business initiative here in the United States. I think you can generalize. And you just go and you do a lot of education of politicians. What are companies and what do they do? And what is a board of directors? It's like duckies and doggies stuff, but they don't know it. What does a board of directors do? What can they decide? What's the difference between the board and management? What do asset managers do? Who is their fiduciary duty to? You know, what are asset owners? I had this conversation with some people in private equity the other day. And so and we're early stages, as I said, we just filed the paperwork. But you know, the early kind of comments are people are very enthusiastic about this, companies and investors, because they want this sort of rational middle center place. People will come to it that have different political views. Those will be reflected, but they're not going to be driven by an ideology. Right now, there's no space to have that conversation. All the airtime, all the bandwidth, all the stuff in the press, you know, is what's happening on the extremes. And so we're trying to deal with that. In a way, it's more challenging because it's necessarily more complicated and it's more nuanced and there's more compromises. And so it's harder to have sound bites about it. But I think we need it. And, you know, we're putting this together very carefully. We're going to have a range of the way we have an academic advisory board, an advisory board, and a fiduciary board. You know, it will reflect different backgrounds. It'll reflect different, you know, political ideologies. It'll be diverse. It's interesting, right? It'll be diverse in all the usual ways we think about diversity, you know, gender and color and race and stuff. But when you look at how this has played out in the United States, like in elite institutions. You got every kind of diversity, but political diversity. You know, the Harvard Corporation, right? The highest level governing body of Harvard, which has got its own issues. They're all Democrats. All the contributions they made a couple of years ago were to Democrats, except the private equity guy gave a little bit of money to Republicans. And so how can an institution like Harvard, in a really complex environment with all of these stakeholders, it's only kind of beaten up now by, you know, a lot of these people in Congress. How can you have good governance without having political diversity? And that's what we're trying to do. You know, and I get some grief from, you know, my more liberal friends, and Tim gets some grief from some of his, you know, more right-wing Republican friends. But, you know, that's life. And I don't care, because I can flip a 550-pound tire. And I used to be able to deadlift 410, but I'm sure I can do 350 again. So it's what I'm all about.
And I think this initiative that you mentioned is really the thing we need, right? Creating platforms where people can just talk to each other more and understand each other's perspectives. So unfortunately, we're already coming towards the end of our podcast interview. And maybe one thing that we would really like to hear from you is bringing this perspective of numbers and narratives together. Do you have any personal anecdote that you have experienced over the years in this field of sustainable business that you want to share with us, that is about maybe this relationship between numbers and narratives?
Boy, it's a good question. So this will be an unusual example probably to give you, and Judith knows about this. And so, to the consternation of some of my colleagues, Philip Morris International is a client of mine, and they're a tobacco company. And people hate tobacco, but the fact of the matter is you're not going to eliminate smoking without engagement with the tobacco industry. And so I won't get into the details, but basically they're going through this remarkable business transformation. And their narrative is to create a smoke-free future, and that cigarettes could be eliminated in 10 to 15 years in certain companies with the right regulations. So that's why the importance of regulation. When it comes to reporting, they have business transformation metrics about how they're reducing their cigarette sales, about how many countries they can sell these reducers products. They report according to the ISSB. They'll report according to the CSRD. They are AAA on CDP for the only one that's American for forests and water and climate. And so I think it's an example, and I've been working with them for 4 years, where they've had support from the board of directors. They have a statement of purpose in their proxy statement. And, you know, they're very sophisticated about their narrative, and they're very clear. I mean, the board of directors, it's in the proxy statement, which is an official filing document. They do integrated reporting, so they've pulled it all together. And I have to say, I know it's, you know, some people are unhappy about this, but if every, just take the large listed companies that have got the capabilities to do so, if every company was at that level of sophistication, statement of purpose and an official filing document, integrated reporting, very clear about trade-offs, very clear about where they stand on regulation, what they can do, what they can't do, you know, that's what we need to have happen, right? So I don't have that much time, so I can't work with that many companies. But I think, you know, if every company was kind of following those same general principles, that would be a great way to come to terms with, you know, all the things we've been talking about, you know, in this interview.
That's excellent. And so we already know about your magic wand, so we won't ask you about that. It's the carbon tax, which is a pretty, I like that. It's a crisp answer. But I will ask you to give me one very, very final piece of advice for either companies or investors. If you would just want to point them into one direction, tell them what to do, what would that be?
So the one simple piece of advice would be to not try and kind of go silent and do greenwashing, as they say it. It's what we said earlier, what I said earlier about being proactive in their narrative, but be more candid about trade-offs, negative externalities, and what you're doing about them, right? And we don't have time. I can cite examples of this. And so I think, you know, what got us into a lot of trouble was, you know, investors overstating ESG funds without even clearly knowing what it was, and companies doing the same thing. I think if there was just more candor rather than worry. So candor is going to lead to people being unhappy with you. And so that's why they tend to try and not want to do it. But it doesn't work. Then everybody ends up unhappy with them. So at least narrow the group of people that are unhappy with you, because you've been very clear about what you think you can and can't do. And then that's the basis upon which the people that may be arguing on the other side against sustainability You know, you're again, you're sort of you're shaping the narrative rather than just being playing defense all the time when you're getting sort of, you know, attacked from the left and the right. One last piece of thing you didn't ask me that I think is important for everybody is I do notice a certain kind of doomsday pessimism. You see it when it comes to climate, you see in other things. And it's like, I think you need to kind of deal with how serious these issues are and you need to acknowledge them, but you can't give up, right? I mean, you have to be optimistic. I mean, be proactive, you know, be an NGO, whatever it is that you want to do and how you think you're making a difference. But if you don't maintain some degree of optimism and hope, then that's not going to be helpful. And I guess the last thing is just don't assume that people that disagree with you are your enemy. You know, maybe they've got some points of view that are useful. And so you may disagree with them on a whole bunch of stuff, but don't then write them off. If there's an issue you can agree with them on, like climate, and you don't agree on reproductive rights, you can't let that keep you from having the conversation. And I think there's too much, at least in this country, of a general litmus test. Unless you kind of adhere to every element of the catechism, you're going to get excommunicated from the church. And that's a polarization that's not useful. So it's like, recognize the serious issues, you know, be optimistic and hopeful in what you can do, and try and collaborate with people that see the world differently than you do if you agree something's a problem. So that's my parting shots before I go forward.
Amazing, Bob. Thank you so much. That was wonderful. So, you know, analysis, candor, optimism, and openness to dialogue. I think those are wonderful points to make. And thank you so much for your time and being part of this podcast.
Pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity. Have a good weekend.